ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, a massive earthquake off the coast of Taiwan causes widespread damage. The death toll is still unclear. Also, allegations Channel 7 paid for drugs and sex workers for former Liberal Party staffer Bruce Lehrman. And who is Samantha Mostyn, the woman set to become Australia's next Governor-General?
She's done so many different things, so she's sort of equally at home in the business world as she is in the not-for-profit world, in grassroots communities. I don't know anybody who's got the kind of breadth and depth of her experience.
First tonight, Taiwan has been rocked by an earthquake and several aftershocks, the strongest to hit the island in at least 25 years. The quake, measuring 7.4 in magnitude according to the US Geological Survey, struck the eastern city of Hualien. At least four people have died and another 57 injured, while local media are reporting other people are still trapped inside buildings. And a tsunami warning was issued for the islands of southern Japan and the Philippines. Our reporter David Taylor has more.
An eerie silence comes over this street in Taiwan's capital, Taipei, moments after the quake struck. The silence is broken by a man's cries. Taiwan television stations showed footage of buildings leaning at precarious angles in the sparsely populated eastern county of Hualien, near the quake's epicentre. This man was in his home study when it began shaking, books falling to the floor as he continues filming. Taiwan's official central news agency says the quake, which struck just off the east coast, was the biggest to hit the island nation since 1999, when a 7.6 magnitude quake killed around 2,400 people. To give you some idea, an earthquake of this magnitude means most unreinforced concrete block walls collapse, and people find it impossible to remain standing or move without crawling. We know so far from today's events, more than 90,000 homes are without power, roads have collapsed, and dramatic footage has aired of landslides across Taiwan. Tsunami warnings and sirens were activated, but later downgraded. University of Adelaide earthquake expert Alan Collins says Taiwan is especially prone to earthquakes.
Yeah, so it was early this morning. There was quite a large earthquake. So you're right, the magnitudes are sort of still a bit in fluctuation, but around about 7.4, which is pretty big. Earthquake occurred on the east coast of Taiwan, and there's been some aftershocks, some pretty big aftershocks. So there was a 6.5 magnitude aftershock just 15 minutes or so later.
Authorities say the main earthquake was roughly 15 kilometres underground. Alan Collins says that depth reduces the impact it has at ground level. And while Taiwan prepares well for these geological events, he expects the death toll to rise.
Wouldn't be the least bit surprised if we see more casualties as time goes on. But you're right, it certainly doesn't seem to have caused a huge amount of destruction. But I would expect there would still be some pretty large aftershocks, and they always have a big threat, the aftershocks, because of course the earlier shocks can weaken infrastructure with an aftershock sort of breaks its back, as it were. But I would expect this not to have a huge further footprint.
A significant concern now is the number of people trapped in buildings and under rubble. The BBC's John Sudworth.
Many people who've never been to Taiwan don't know just how rugged this island is and how big the mountains are, but they are very large indeed. The largest mountains in East Asia are in the centre of Taiwan. And those remote valleys, it's going to be difficult, it's going to take time, it'll probably take the military and helicopters to get in there to try and see what the situation is. So the situation is going to develop in the coming hours and I suspect the coming days. This was a very big shake.
Schools and work have been suspended. Taiwan's Defence Ministry has dispatched military troops to coordinate evacuation efforts in conjunction with local governments. Japan's Prime Minister has offered his condolences and assistance to Taiwan, saying Japan stands ready to provide any assistance necessary. Aftershocks are expected for the next few days.
David Taylor reporting. There have been more sensational revelations today in Bruce Lehrman's defamation case against Network 10 and journalist Lisa Wilkinson. Mr. Lehrman, a former Liberal staffer, sued both the broadcaster and Ms. Wilkinson after they aired an interview in which his former colleague, Brittany Higgins, alleged she'd been raped in Parliament House. Mr. Lehrman has consistently denied any wrongdoing and no findings have been made against him. Now a sworn statement from a former producer at the Seven Network alleges the broadcaster made a number of payments to Mr. Lehrman as it attempted to secure an exclusive interview with him. Taylor Auerbach says the payments included reimbursing Mr. Lehrman for money spent on illegal drugs and sex workers. Patrick Bell is covering the case. Patrick, what can you tell us about these payments to Bruce Lehrman?
Well, Sam, there are a number of payments that Taylor Auerbach has claimed in his affidavit that either he personally or the network paid on a number of different areas. But perhaps the most significant revelation was Taylor Auerbach's claim that Bruce Lehrman was reimbursed for money that he had spent on illicit drugs and to engage sex workers. This was over a period of 2 days in January 2023. Some of the other payments that have been outlined include a further 3 weeks' rent for Mr. Lehrman at a property in Sydney's East. You'll recall that during the trial in the defamation case last year, it was revealed that Channel 7 paid for a year's worth of Mr. Lehrman's rent in a property that he's still in at the moment. There was also a golf trip to Tasmania, multiple meals at Sydney restaurants, and the detail that began to emerge in the last couple of weeks around payments for Thai massages that Mr. Lehrman and a friend allegedly received in November 2022. Now, the reason that's important is because at that stage, the ACT DPP at the time, Shane Drumgold, hadn't actually dropped the criminal case against Bruce Lehrman. There was still the prospect of a retrial. So it demonstrates just how early he was talking to the Seven Network and perhaps negotiating an interview. And according to Taylor Auerbach's affidavit, the lengths that the network and he were going to perhaps to meet some of Mr. Lehrman's requests.
So how are these payments then relevant to Mr. Lehrman's defamation case against the Ten Network and Lisa Wilkinson?
Well, it's very difficult to find a way that they are directly relevant. The reason Network 10 wanted to call Taylor Auerbach was that he is expected to testify that Bruce Lehrman provided material to Channel 7 that he shouldn't have provided under court rules. And this is material such as a lengthy extract of Brittany Higgins's text messages, which was part of the brief of evidence in his criminal case, but wasn't tendered in court. And usually the practice is that such material can't then be used for another purpose. So that's the reason Taylor Auerbach became a person of interest, if you like, in this case. But he has gone on to make some rather sensational revelations in his affidavit, which has been filed to the federal court and released by the court today.
So the case returns to court tomorrow. What can we expect at the hearing?
Well, Taylor Auerbach, as I say, is expected to come into the witness box tomorrow afternoon. He will likely face cross-examination tomorrow from Mr. Lehrman's lawyers. Before that, though, the Seven Network is required to answer to a subpoena that has called for some of the documents that may relate to efforts that it went to obtain this interview and some of its communications with Bruce Lehrman. And depending on how it responds to that, there may be questions for Seven Network representatives as to what has occurred to some of those communications, because Taylor Auerbach is also alleged in his affidavit that he was instructed, whether directly or indirectly, to delete some of those communications before that Spotlight episode went to air. So there's a bit more to come on this case yet. We thought a judgment was happening tomorrow, but still some more detail to emerge before a possible judgment now next week.
Patrick Bell reporting. The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, says he and the Foreign Minister have made clear their outrage at the death of Australian aid worker Zomi Frankem clear to their Israeli counterparts. Israel has promised to investigate how she and six colleagues were killed by a missile strike while travelling in what was thought to be a safe zone. Some international lawyers are calling for Israel to face criminal prosecutions for the deaths. Alexandra Humphreys reports.
Emotions are still running high in Australia after the death of Zomi Frankem in Gaza. And against that backdrop, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has now spoken with Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He says he made clear his anger over the unacceptable incident.
When I spoke with the Prime Minister, I emphasised the importance of full accountability and transparency. And Prime Minister Netanyahu has committed to full transparency about how this tragedy could possibly have occurred. There is a need for a thorough investigation into what happened here, and Prime Minister Netanyahu committed to that.
The Prime Minister also repeated his call for Israel to make sure humanitarian assistance can be safely delivered in Gaza. The airstrike on the World Central Kitchen convoy killed 43-year-old Zomi Frankem, along with six of her colleagues. Israel has admitted its military is responsible and promised an investigation. But Prime Minister Netanyahu also says this happens in war.
I conveyed to Prime Minister Netanyahu in very clear terms that Australians were outraged by this death.
Foreign Minister Penny Wong has discussed the incident with her counterpart in Israel.
I would say to Mr. Netanyahu that wartime does not obviate responsibility for observing international humanitarian law, including the protection of aid workers. Unless Israel, Mr. Netanyahu, changes his course of action, Israel will continue to lose support. We say to Mr. Netanyahu, you must change course.
Liberal Senator Dave Sharma has previously served as an ambassador to Israel.
If it's shown, and I think it will be shown, that this was a mistake and a terrible and tragic one that's cost many people lives, then Israel should apologise for it. That's what I would expect, and that's what we would do in a similar situation if we're in a wartime operation.
In central Gaza, images have emerged of the vehicles that had been carrying the aid workers. One vehicle's rooftop logo identifying it as belonging to the World Central Kitchen charity has been obliterated. The car's interior is destroyed. This man, Jariz, claims he saw Israeli forces target the charity's vehicles.
I'm living here in the tents next to them where the strike happened. There's a burnt vehicle there, and this is the second one. And both are armoured cars, so it is obvious they belong to foreigners. We suddenly saw the strike on them and we ran to evacuate them. What can we say? May God bless them, whoever they were.
Graham Blewett is a retired New South Wales magistrate and was a deputy prosecutor at the United Nations International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. He believes Israel's investigation into what happened should result in harsh punishments.
At the very least, I would expect this investigation would identify who was responsible for giving the order to fire the weapon. And given that background, I would expect those persons responsible for that act to be prosecuted for murder.
How transparent do you think Israel is likely to be with what it finds out when it looks into this?
I think given the amount of international condemnation that is occurring as a result of it, I think they cannot afford not to be transparent. And whilst there may be some persons held responsible, maybe they will be scapegoats, I don't know. But I would expect that there should be total transparency and that there should be criminal sanctions against those who were responsible. And it shouldn't just be a slap on the wrist and saying what they are saying, oh, well, bad things happen in war. Well, it's just not good enough.
Mr. Blewett expects answers to come quickly.
That's one strike, and they, if the IDF don't know who was responsible for it, well, then it shows that they don't have any control over their military forces on the ground, and that would demonstrate a much broader problem for the Israelis.
World Central Kitchen has paused its operations in the region and labelled the strike an attack on humanitarian organisations showing up in the most dire of situations where food is being used as a weapon of war.
Alexandra Humphreys. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. Just a reminder, you can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Ahead, an inquest into the death of a 16-year-old Indigenous boy in custody underway in Western Australia. Businesswoman and gender equality advocate Samantha Mostyn is to be Australia's next Governor-General. King Charles has approved her appointment after she was recommended by the Prime Minister. Ms. Mostyn will be just the second woman to assume the role and the first Governor-General with a lengthy career in the business sector. This report from Alison Shaw.
From the 1st of July, Sam Mostyn will be the King's representative in Canberra.
I'm deeply honoured by this great privilege and look forward to representing the values, hopes and aspirations of all Australians. I will never underestimate or take for granted the expectations that come with high office, and I am ready to serve with integrity, compassion and respect. And I can think of no greater purpose, Prime Minister, than to serve this country I love as Governor General. Particularly at a time in our history when the challenges and opportunities we face are large and complex.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese making the announcement this morning.
Sam Mostyn is an exceptional leader who represents the best of modern Australia.
She's the first business leader to be appointed as Governor-General, where she'll play a crucial role, approving bills to become law and holding the power to appoint and dismiss ministers. Appointed an officer of the Order of Australia 3 years ago, Sam Mostyn has spent decades advising governments, working at the highest levels of Australian companies and holding senior roles in non-profit organisations. Lisa Anise worked with Ms. Mostyn at the Diversity Council of Australia and says she's passionate and experienced.
She really is one of these people that cares about a better future for all Australians. She is an incredibly ethical, very inclusive, respectful person who cares deeply about all people. And she's been across so many areas of the Australian community, whether that's the world that I work in, which is equality, or the world of sport, or the arts, or the environment, or business and the law.
Sam Mostyn was the first woman appointed to the AFL Commission in 2005, serving for more than a decade. She played a key role in setting up the Women's League. She's also spent six seasons on the board of the Sydney Swans. The club's chair is Andrew Pridham, who's known Ms. Mostyn for two decades.
Her passion and advocacy that I've seen over many years for the Indigenous community, for women, gender diversity, for inclusion is second to none. I've never met anyone as passionate about those causes as she is.
Australia's next Governor-General also has a legal background, as well as experience on the boards of the Climate Council and mental health organisation Beyond Blue. Georgie Harmon is CEO of Beyond Blue and says Ms. Mostyn is an incisive leader.
I've worked with her for years, and she is just the most incredible leader. She is kind, she is compassionate, she can zoom in, she can zoom out. And she's made such an incredible impact on our organisation and our work to support the community in a relatively short space of time. She can argue with the best of them, she listens well. She believes in the mental wealth of Australia, and that's so she moves the conversation past mental health and the health system to the things that actually keep us mentally well. A good education, safe, stable, affordable housing, connection to community, great relationships, lifting people out of poverty. So she's worked with the board to deliver a new strategy, a new strategic direction for Beyond Blue for the next 5 years, which is incredibly exciting.
One of Sam Mostyn's most recent roles was as chair of a government task force into women's equality, which was asked to recommend ways to improve the financial position of women. Professor Ray Cooper was a member of that task force and is a friend of Ms. Mostyn's. She spoke to ABC Radio in Melbourne, describing the news as a great surprise.
I was floored. I got a text from my mother saying, "Isn't that Sam, a friend of yours? Turn the telly on."
Professor Cooper says Sam Mostyn has been a true leader in developing policies to boost the status of women.
We were, you know, given the guiding instructions by the Minister for Women to come up with a blueprint for a gender equal economy over the next 10 years. And Sam kept coming back through all of those conversations about, what about the workers who are working in the early childhood centre? What about the aged care workers and the women working in supermarkets? Rather than talking only at the level of, you know, corporate Australia, but just thinking about what real Australians' experiences are and what the daily lives and the daily work of people are.
The Australian Republic movement has praised the choice of Sam Mostyn as the incoming Governor-General, but says the highest leadership role in Australia should be elected, not appointed. Sam Mostyn will be the country's 28th Governor-General, taking over from General David Hurley.
Alison Shaw reporting. Susan Harris-Rimmer is a professor at Griffith University's Law School and has known Sam Mostyn for 25 years. She told me she's thrilled her friend is to be the next Governor-General.
It's an inspired choice. I must admit it was a total shock to me, but it makes perfect sense. She is going to be unbelievably good in that role.
Why do you say an inspired choice?
Because of all the Australian leaders I've ever met, she has the most breadth. She's done so many different things, so she's sort of equally at home in the business world as she is in the not-for-profit world, in grassroots communities, with young people, with the arts community. Like, she's done a lot of different types of roles, so it makes her a really perfect choice for Governor General because she is connected to all different sectors of Australian life. You know, and sport as well. I don't know anybody who's got the kind of breadth and depth of her experience.
Yes, I've been reading her CV today and it certainly takes quite a while. What does that say to you about her personality, or what can you tell us about her personality, that she's played a role in so many spheres of Australian life but largely gone under the radar?
If you kind of have ever met her, you'd never forget it. And I'm really grateful that so many Australians are now going to get to know her. I think she's got boundless energy and this incredibly strong sense of service. So I think that's her defining feature. And she's also unbelievably smart for the legal community. I'm sure everyone's going to tell you the same thing. She's one of our best and brightest of Australian lawyers. But unlike a lot of us, she's just done a really wide-ranging set of roles. So she's had that strong service ethos right from the beginning and a real commitment to strategy. She's a very strategic person.
What do you point to as being her main achievements?
I was very impressed by her work for the Women's Economic Equality Task Force. That was some very serious strategy, consultation, very diverse stakeholders, very complicated policy, and she did a really great job leading that work. But I'm a footy girl and I'm also incredibly impressed. You know, imagine being the first female AFL commissioner. That's brave. And she made a huge impact on that sport, both in terms of governance, you know, integrity and the development of the women's game.
She's going to be the King's representative in Australia. Do you know much about her views on the monarchy and an Australian republic?
I have no idea, actually. I think if she's accepted the role, she would do so with the utmost integrity. So I'm sure she's thought about that. And I think she will be a very modern Governor General. I think she's primarily interested in good governance. But I'm sure she has, in terms of representing the King, she has very similar views around environmentalism and climate change and the development of young people's leadership. She is very interested in Australia's future in terms of technology, in terms of climate change, in terms of young people. I think that's a great quality for a Governor General at this point in time. So, yes, I think of all the Governor Generals, she's been probably the one with her eye on the future of Australia. So I think she's a very good person in that role at this particular point in history.
You do a lot of research into gender equality and women's rights. Why do you think Australia has only had two female governors general?
I think it's because governor generals are the best of the best. They pick them from people who are already acknowledged leaders. And so it's been quite recently that we've been able to see women come to the top of their fields in law, in the military, in politics. So, you know, that's why I think it's taken us a long time to then get people like Quentin Bryce and Sam Mostyn, but they are two really wonderful examples of female leadership. I couldn't have asked for two better names to be picked for Governor General. They're both amazing women and they're very accessible, consultative leaders. Very lucky to have met both of them. They both kind of radiate decency. And, you know, that's a really lovely quality. They both really care about Australia's values, Australian values and our reputation in the world and making us a better place for everyone to live. I think that's really rare and beautiful. And I'm so glad we get a chance to see these exceptional women in these roles, and they make it easier for the women that are going to come after them.
Professor Susan Harris-Rimmer from Griffith University's Law School. A warning, this next story contains the name of an Indigenous person who's died and mentions of self-harm that you may find distressing. A coronial inquest in Western Australia has heard a 16-year-old boy who died in custody had threatened to take his own life on 8 occasions in one night. Cleveland Dodd died last year after self-harming in detention. It was the first time a child has died in custody in the state. Our reporter Isabel Massali was at the inquest in Perth today. Isabel, what's been revealed so far about Cleveland Dodd's death?
Well, Sam, deaths in custody are subject to coronial inquests, but at the start of this one, the coroner explained this is unprecedented in a few ways. As you mentioned, it's the first death of its kind in WA, but it's also occurred in a facility built for adults, not for young people. Cleveland was a 16-year-old Indigenous teenager who we now know had a history of offending, some periods spent in youth detention, and mental health issues. The inquest was also told today that incidents of self-harm and threats of self-harm are not uncommon in youth detention, and there is a threat staff can become desensitised. Counsel assisting Anthony Crocker said the day-to-day running of youth detention facilities occur behind closed doors, but this inquest will open those doors to allow critical analysis. So today we started to get a picture of a chain of failures on the night that Cleveland self-harmed. For example, the air vent Cleveland used in his self-harm incident was damaged and due for repair. The officer responding didn't carry a radio on him despite being required to. Cleveland's camera was covered by tissues for 11 hours, meaning the guards couldn't see him, and he had threatened self-harm 8 times that night in question. We were also played CCTV footage of the officer tasked with getting the keys to his cell, and counsel assisting said what information he had and what situation he thought he was responding to will be examined later, but judging by the footage, he did not appear to be hurried. This occurred at moments that could have been crucial to saving Cleveland's life.
And so what have you heard about the facility where Cleveland Dodd was held?
So Cleveland was being held in the notorious Unit 18. Back in 2022, this unit was opened inside a maximum security adult prison in Perth to accommodate some young people. It was meant to be a temporary unit set up amid a range of issues at WA's only youth detention facility, Banksia Hill, but we're still awaiting a closure date for Unit 18. So since it was set up, there's been a lot of backlash from advocates who say it's not suitable for young people to be kept at this facility and it's not helping to break the cycle of youth offending. So the fact that Cleveland Dodd died in a facility that wasn't meant to hold young people to begin with was mentioned today and will be one focus of this inquest.
And what have the family had to say about the inquest?
So his family have travelled from parts of regional WA to attend this inquest in Perth, and because it's been fast-tracked, they say they've barely had time to process their grief, but they hope this inquest will provide some answers and closure. Here's what Cleveland Dodd's grandmother, Glenda Mippy, had to say.
Well, we just come out of the inquest and what we saw on the TV was very wrong. While Cleveland laid in that cell, gasping for breath to save himself, they strolled down the hallway, stole down to the office, came back, turned lights on, getting dressed. They just took their time. No one was running around. No one was panicking. No, nothing. They just took their time. Then 8 times, he told them, 8 times he was going to hurt himself, and none of them took it serious. They left it. They left him there in that cell until something happened. 8 times he told them. No, it's the first time we heard it. 8 times today in there was the first time we heard it was 8 times. We heard that he told them, but not 8 times.
The inquest will be held in 2 parts. Over the next week or so, we'll hear evidence from the staff working on that night. And a second part in July will examine the broader facility and system with the hope of preventing a similar tragedy in the future.
Isabel Massali reporting. And if you need help or someone you know does, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14 or 13 YARN. That's a crisis support service for Indigenous people. The number 13 92 76. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You'll find all our interviews and reports on the PM webpage, and you can catch the program live or later on the ABC Listen app. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Israel says it was a mistake, but how does a military manage to bomb a clearly marked aid convoy? Today, a longtime aid worker, Tim Costello, on why no one trying to deliver aid in Gaza is safe and what the world should do about it. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.